Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and your moderator for today. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guests, Robert and Dana Baer, former CIA officers and authors of the new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. I think we're in for a treat this evening with an unusual convergence of timing and interest around what's happening in the Middle East. Robert Baer was one of the foremost CIA officers in the Middle East for many years. He joined the CIA in 1977. His wife, Dana, had a different role. She joined the CIA in 1990. She went to the University of California here at Berkeley. And I'm looking forward to hearing their stories tonight and also talking a little bit about what's happening in the world today. Please welcome Robert and Dana Baer. Your book is pretty remarkable. It's both a combination of a spy story, really, and a personal story. So let me start with you, Dana, and tell us why you joined the CIA.
Well, I did my undergrad at Berkeley, and then I was getting a master's in social welfare at UCLA, and I, you know, just went through on-campus recruiting. And it wasn't like they had there was no booth and CIA people there recruiting or anything like this. Was anything out in the open, but, you know, they had a small little poster up somewhere, and I just sort of threw my resume in a pile. And, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles. I think, you know, when you're the West Coast, I think it's just a lot different. You don't think that much about working for the federal government, so it wasn't anything that I'd thought of. I didn't read spy books as a kid or anything like that. But, you know, I was intrigued by the possibility of travel and something maybe a little different from what I grew up.
Robert, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about why you joined the CIA, but one of the interesting things in your book, and we just talked a little bit about this, was your very personal account and story of the impact of your life on your family. And why did you choose to get into that in this book?
It was books about alienation. When I was 10 years old, my mother divorced and took me to Europe for 3 years, and I lived out of, we lived in a car, essentially, driving all around Europe, drove to Moscow. So the whole idea of, exile, abandonment, leaving family behind was, part of my life. It wasn't something strange. I could get up and leave and go somewhere, and I think that's why the CIA hired me. I was 22 years old. I was studying Mandarin at Berkeley. I didn't even have a place to live. I would sleep on the couch of a friend, and he suggested I get a job, and as a joke, I called the Federal Center here and asked for the CIA. And no, seriously, it was that random, and they wouldn't give me a number, but they gave me a number in Lawndale, California. Has anybody been to Lawndale? It's out in the middle of nowhere, and I wrote them, they sent an application back, and I was absolutely convinced I wasn't going to get in. I had an interview down the street here at the Hilton, and that was all very strange. I called up to a guy's room, and he said, go in the southwest corner and wait. Call me back in 30 minutes. And this went on for like an hour. And so I wanted to be a journalist, actually. I wanted to write, and I thought this is a great experience, applying to the CIA and getting refused. And then 21 years later, I'm still in.
Dana, can you tell us, since this is a love story, how you met and the circumstances of your assignment and what your first impression was of this guy?
Well, first of all, my training, it was a totally different path than Bob's. I trained to learn how to blend in any situation and be invisible, and I went through a lot of weapons training and high-speed driving and crazy skills.
Describe some of the high-speed driving training you do in the book, but it might be interesting.
You can learn how to drive down, 70 miles an hour and run a car off the road. And
it does a nice flip, too, just right off the
side. all these really, really useful skills. I was also trained to do a lot of surveillance work, and, a lot of that is, can you sit at a bus stop for 4 hours without anybody noticing you anywhere in the world? A lot of disguise and that type of thing. So I was actually assigned to work for an operation that Bob was doing in Sarajevo, and I show up, and I was just told to meet Harold at a restaurant in town, and I show up, and he's driving a lime green car that's got Orangina plastered down the side. So, the sparks at first were not, there was nothing like that. In fact, I was a little bit concerned for my team's welfare at that point. So that's how we met. And, Bob had a house that he had rented. There was no place to live at that time. All the hotels were closed and the windows were shot out. And he had somehow rented a house that was out off of the way from the, about by the airport in the suburbs of Sarajevo, and there was no place for me to stay, so I ended up having to move into this house that had no electricity and no water, and he'd rigged a hose from Mount Igman. This is, icy cold water. He had it up through the second floor, and that's how we flushed toilets and took showers, and it wasn't, there was no love story until way after Sarajevo was over.
Tell everybody, what's the frame around the moment in Sarajevo? What's happening?
It was the Civil War. The Bosnian Muslims were under an existential threat from shelling. And the Iranians, in the absence of international decision, sort of like we see in Libya, were arming the Bosnian Muslims and sending trainers in and doing all sorts of things for them. So it was a government very attached to Iran and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the militants. And what had happened is shortly before, Dane and I, in fact, we were sent there for this reason, is Hezbollah had attempted to kidnap and murder a CIA operative there. He was pulled out in the middle of the night. Dana and I were brought in along with a larger team to put surveillance on Hezbollah to figure out who they were, where their safe houses were, where they were living, and the rest of it. And we had what we're calling in the book is a parabolic mic, a directional mic that can read through walls. It's a very amazing piece of equipment. So if you could listen into a Hezbollah safe house and get the translations, and then we were going to use NATO troops to take down some of these safe houses. That was the plan.
Explain how you set up the parabolic mic. I mean, in the book, you really get into detail about the placement of it and how that's monitored, and I guess that's one of the things you were allowed to describe.
Yeah, by the way, the book was, every word was cleared by the CIA. It's just not worth it to be a whistleblower up against the CIA.
When you join there, you sign something that says, anything you write basically for public consumption has to be cleared by them. So we worked with them for about a year to make sure this book was cleared. It's also the reason why we can't really give prepared speeches. So
we can't talk from notes. So.
But the parabolic mic is, we set it up actually across in an apartment building. It can read through walls across the river into another building on the other side of the, I guess it's the Miljacka River, which runs right through Sarajevo. So that's, and it takes in the information. It was getting us names and addresses, and we were sort of coordinating that with trying to get taking photos of license plates, and the whole idea was to match it all up and try to run down who these people were. And that led into, once we got this information, then what were we going to do with it? We're in Sarajevo. It's not like you can call the DMV, so how do you get that? How do you get where do these people live and exactly who their names are? And that led into partly what Bob's job was, and that was to try to recruit somebody. We targeted a local policeman to who could help us possibly run traces on the information that we got.
It was, you know, women in espionage, and I'll tell it's your story, but we needed to meet a policeman. Remember, they were all more or less very close to the Iranians, so it had to look innocent. You just don't knock on the door. And so one night, Dana parked her car in front of a police station. You can tell the rest of the story.
Well, I parked my car, my rental car, in front of a police station, and you can use ground-up spark plugs. I went out and bought some spark plugs, stomped on them with my boot, and if you hit at them just sort of on a slight angle and you throw them at a car window, it'll shatter. That's one of the side windows. So we had, my team and I, we sort of set this up in advance, and we put a few empty suitcases and things in the back of the car, and we walked by middle of the night, broke the window, and then the next morning I went into the police station and said, you know, oh my gosh, my car's been broken into, you know, trying to get somebody that could speak English, finally got a very young policeman who was willing to help, and oh my gosh, we need to file a report, and it's sort of a building up of a relationship that you try to do, and I would go back day after day trying to, you know, have you found anything? You know, have any more information? Should I put a ad in the newspaper? And finally just sort of dropped it in, oh, you know, you should come and meet my friend Harold. You know, he might have some part-time work for you. So that's how we...
That's the root of manipulation.
And how did you explain who you were and why you were in Sarajevo?
Let's see, what was that? I have to think about what I was doing. So many different things I was doing.
Location, was it your location scout?
Most of the time, I described myself as a location scout, a Hollywood location scout, because, one, you can have a camera with you anywhere. Two, people love Hollywood and they love to talk movies, so it's always a way to meet people and talk and try to exchange information. So, you were... an arms dealer.
I posed as an arms dealer. Well, no, there's a good reason for this. You know, it's like the car with the Orangina. It was like the purloined letter. You figure, you know, if you hide it, you put it out in the open, people are never going to suspect you're a spy. So I always had a case of Cuban Cohiba cigars, bottle of plum brandy, and posing as an arms dealer. And I actually had brochures for various arms for KA-50 helicopters, anybody who knows Russian helicopters. And it seemed to work. They either thought that or I was a lunatic. But they didn't. I think CIA was sort of far down their list because it was all so crazy.
Well, one of the phrases you use in the book, I think, Dana, how do you learn to become invisible? Which you can talk a little bit about. But where does the anxiety, fear factor, risk factor in psychologically? I mean, what's your mindset as you're doing what you're doing there, and talk a little bit about how you become invisible.
You know, usually when, depends on where I was working, the first thing you do when you get there is, what is everybody dressed like? What kind of car is everybody driving? Go to the local market, buy all local clothes, dye your hair. You know, just try to look as much like the local people as possible, you know. I mean, obviously, I couldn't work in Asian countries and things like that, but I did work all over, you know, the Middle East. You can wear headscarf and all over Europe. And so, you know, that for one. And then when you're doing surveillance or you're sitting somewhere for an extended period of time, it really becomes sort of a heightened. You have a heightened sense of what's going on around you, and you know all the little things, the little extraneous noises and stuff. They just sort of get filtered out, and you just really, if you're concentrating. I mean, there's lots of times. I'm trying to think of an example of something. You know, lots of times go to an airport and wait for somebody to get off an airplane, and you can, you know, you blend in, find a chair, sit there, see how, you know, for hours upon hours upon hours, waiting for your person that you've probably been given a picture of to get off the plane, and then follow him to wherever he's going. So,
and it's also, if I could just interject something, it's not my story, but the protective stuff, carrying a weapon, a Glock, it's a lot easier for a woman to carry a pistol because that's the last person they suspect in a room if things go bad is the petite woman pulling out a pistol and start shooting people, as opposed to the guy with a buzz haircut and, you know, the rest of it and, you know, in a vest, because that's, you immediately suspect him. And the CIA has figured this out, how to go invisible when it wants to.
Well, one of the things I think in one of your chapters, and the way the book is written, they alternate chapters telling a story. You talked about never carrying a weapon, but I think, or you rarely carried a weapon. I think, did you write that, or?
I think I did. I mean, I was
but you were
heavily
trained.
Weapons
trained. Why don't you describe
trained,
your training and, a little, if you can?
You know, I went to training and had not ever even held a weapon before. And it just, it's repetitive and over and over and over. And, you know, they just start you out slow. I was by far the least qualified or the person that had the least experience. Most of the people I trained with were ex-military of some sort. They, you know, just a lot of range time, a lot of, you know, rolling out of a car and coming up shooting, a lot of night shooting where they try to throw in extra explosive noises and things to get you rattled, a lot of running, you know, get your heart rate up and then try to shoot.
Tell the story of the house where you had
the test.
The
last part, one of the last, I guess, tests was, I had two. One where I was sort of new and we had a DEA agent in the training with us, and everybody's sort of waiting. You're going through a shoot house, which is basically a house that's got like sandbags or tires all in the walls so that you can shoot at it and the bullets don't go outside of the, don't hurt anybody. And usually these things are set up with like paper targets that can sort of come out from the wall automatically, and they've all got cameras and they're wired, so somebody's listening and watching you as you're going through this, and you've got bulletproof vests on and everything, and you're sort of waiting to take your turn, and it's all this unknown, what's going to jump out at me in this house, and a DEA agent comes over to the side and says to me, hey, you know, I've worked with a lot of women, you know, girls like you, and, you know, you just got to go out of character and just, you know, yell and scream when you get in there and you see some sort of threat, and that's the only way you're going to put people off guard. And at this point, I just, you know, I had been so intimidated through this whole training because it was something so foreign to me, and so I go through the house and I'm, you know, shaking and holding my weapon, and a target pops out at me, and I just screamed at the top of my lungs, something like, you know...
The F word.
Yeah, so I'm not going to say.
There was the F word.
You know, put your effing hands in the air, and or I'm going to blow your effing head off, and, you know, shot the guy twice in the forehead. And came out of the house, and you know, everybody was laughing because I could be heard clear as day. But it was sort of an opening point for me too, because after that, everybody sort of asks me, you know, what was it like working with all these guys? But they all came together because we were a team and we were training as a team, and all of our safety depended on each other. So I never had any, you know, problems with people thinking, oh, you know, what's this girl doing here? So.
Tell us about when you, a couple of times, or an example of your career maybe, Bob, when things broke down and you really had, you were at risk or had to quickly vacate because whatever you were doing was exposed.
What happens is I spent my entire career in war zones. And the first one where it was really a hot war was Lebanon in the 80s during the Civil War. And the first time we were shelled with these rocket tubes, and the whole place just shook. It throws you off, but by the time I got to Iraq in 1995 and we were shelled, I had a problem because it was 10 days of constant shelling was my team started to fall apart. People that hadn't been in war zones, and I had to send them out one at a time and couldn't get back. But like anybody who's been in the military here under fire will know that you just get used to it and you turn off. You don't hear it anymore. Place shakes. You don't think about it. There's no adrenaline involved. You just cut it off and you don't think about it anymore.
Well, that's a in an artillery or Katyusha barrage, you don't feel like you necessarily you're targeted. But was there ever a situation where you knew you were the target or you were being exposed and had to, like, or either one of you really had that, you know, visceral fear where you had to get out and not only protect yourself, but the operation was at risk?
Well, that was in Sarajevo.
It became very clear in Sarajevo that while we were, you know, surveilling this Hezbollah safe house, that somebody was watching us watch them. And we tried to follow, we noticed people taking pictures of us, and we tried to follow them, and as is often the case, you know, we lost them. And a little while after that, one of our teammates was driving home from dinner, and she was ambushed on the road. She and her husband were in the car, and she was shot. And she survived, but that was the end of that operation, and it became one of those pack that up in the middle of the night and drive out of town as quick as possible.
I'm going to switch to the present now. What do you think of the, let me ask Bob, are you surprised at what's going on in the Middle East and Libya, especially Syria, and what you're looking ahead and back? How did this happen and what's going to happen?
I'm surprised, and I don't know of anybody that was not surprised by this. We keep in touch with people that live in the Middle East, that are in the security systems, that we've had frank relationships with us, and each and every one of them, even the intelligence officers, the Arabs, have said this has come as a surprise. This is a black swan, what's happening in the Middle East. Where it's going to go, no one knows. And there are two conflicts in the Middle East. One is tribal. That's Libya. You have in Benghazi, the Misrata tribe defected from Gaddafi. They had previously been loyal, and what we're seeing in Libya is a civil war. And as any civil war, the sides are fairly well balanced. We don't know which way it's going to go. The president authorized airstrikes because it was going to end up in a humanitarian disaster. A million refugees, tens of thousands of people killed by Gaddafi. Gaddafi's out of his mind, and he couldn't be troubled. He couldn't manage this. He's got this Bedouin mentality. That's a tribal conflict. Egypt, you simply have a military coup d'etat. What we're seeing in Yemen is a military coup d'etat, which started 2 days ago when the commanding general Al-Ahmar, who's truly a tribal chief at the end of the day, went to Ali Saleh, the president, and said, "You're out, otherwise it's a civil war." So again, that's tribal. Yemen is tribal. Now what we're seeing in Bahrain is sectarian, which, according to my judgment, is much more dangerous. We're seeing a wedge being driven between the Shia and the Sunni. Now you ask anybody who's not a Muslim what the difference between a Shia and a Sunni, and they'll have a very hard time telling you unless they're a scholar. But for Muslims, it's very clear what it is. Yesterday, Bahrain simply canceled all flights out of the capital that went to Shia countries. It couldn't get any more obvious than that. You have in Lebanon, which is a country divided by sectarian powers, you've got the Shia Hezbollah allied with Amal and allied with Christians are fighting the Sunnis. Sectarian division. Syria, you've got the Alawites, which are a very bizarre form of Shia, are now fighting the Sunni in a city called Dara. If you look at the map of the Middle East, there truly is a Shia crescent that goes from Iran to Iraq to Syria and Lebanon and Bahrain. The interesting part of this is we're seeing a slow motion take over of power in Saudi Arabia from King Abdullah, who he's very, very good, but he's very ill, is slowly, his power is being usurped by his half-brother, Prince Nayef, who's very close to the Wahhabis, very close to the almost bin Laden. And he has started to, he has gone into the this clan in the family and said, what's going to save us is militant Islam. If we go into Bahrain and crush the Shia, truly crush them, we'll win. If we remove the regime in Damascus, this Alawite regime, we stand a better chance. If we go up against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Now the question is, and I don't have the answer, what is Iran going to do? I've heard anecdotal information that the Iranian people are much more attached to Shia Islam than they are to the regime. Khomeini is not Shia Islam. They look at these as, you know, people in their identity is with the Shia, and now they're being truly suppressed in Bahrain, and it's going to get worse in Saudi Arabia. Today there was mass arrests in Saudi Arabia of Shia. There's supposed to be big demonstrations tomorrow, as I understand. And, of course, Friday, as usual, the day of prayer is going to be big. Ask me to predict what's going to happen? I don't know. You know, you can see it in Washington. They can't predict it either. But we are sitting on a volcano in the Middle East. And, frankly, when this thing started in Tunisia with a single vendor, you know, that's the kind of thing you cannot predict. No one saw it. It's not the fault of the CIA. It's not the fault of the press. The Tunisians didn't see it. And, you know, if this veers off and to become sort of Jeffersonian democracy, I'll be surprised. If you get military regimes, I'll be less surprised. If you get a conflict that spreads across the Middle East, one backed by Iran, one backed by Saudi Arabia, the chances are pretty good.
Chances are pretty good that you think that would, that's a scenario.
We're moving toward, each day we're moving closer and closer.
So what you're saying then is that it's not simply each country, you know, sort of fertilizing its own uprisings, but really there's outside influences, and they're driven really by
and people are just
Shiaism
angry.
And Sunnis.
It's the price of wheat. It's the unemployment. It's this cheerful corruption that's gone on for 40 years. The interesting thing is, you know, I find interesting is that so far Israel has not come into anybody's sights. But I got an email today saying that Egypt Air took Israel off its maps, which is not a good sign, nor the bombing in Jerusalem.
So when you're saying Israel's not in anyone's sights, it's really, it's in a sense, it's a conflict based at home, and that
they finally said it's not
of,
Israel; it's the problem; it's the tyrants and the corrupt. Which is a much more sophisticated, you know, revolution, and I think the revolution will have more strength because it is more sophisticated.
So, if you were on the ground now in any of these countries, what would you be? I mean, what's the CIA doing now? Do you think, or is the CIA even a presence in some of these places?
You know, how do you follow ephemera? I don't. I mean, I can't follow things in this country that's in the press every day. I don't understand it. So the CIA is saying, all right, well, how do we get into a village in rural Tunisia and figure out what people are thinking? I mean, it's almost an academic subject rather than an intelligence subject. The CIA can get inside Egypt's military and tell you what the generals are thinking. But if they don't know what's going on in the country, it doesn't do you any good.
Well, one of the things that's been said is that sort of fear has been tamped down, or the fear of fear has been untapped. You know, I think in Dara, one of the things, the catalyst was that they arrested a bunch of children, which infuriated the local people. And I mean, these are things you can't really predict. But is there? I mean, you know Syria much better than anybody in this room, I know. And can you imagine that fear being dissipated in a country like that, which is ruled with such as, you know, iron hand?
I tell you,
the
Syrians we talked to this morning, they're part of the regime, terrified of what's going to happen on Friday. They just don't know. I mean, it could be several cities that are going to rise. Remember Hama in 82. You were there then, you know. But that was an organized movement with guns and what we would call terrorists. What's scary about this, these people aren't terrorists. They're not picking up weapons. This is like Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
They're out in the street, and it's much more difficult to defeat these people. And it's also more difficult to lay the blame at Iran's feet, too, because they're not sending weapons into Bahrain so far. And if it's really, truly spontaneous, how do you control it? As we saw in Egypt, I mean, in Libya, you can't do it with machine guns and tanks.
Is it, and we talk about Iran and their influence through Hezbollah in Lebanon. I mean, what is it, a waiting period there for Hezbollah? Are they watching? Or is this a moment to really stir things up in southern Lebanon with the Israelis?
The fear is that if Lebanon sectarian violence occurs between Lebanese, that Hezbollah or somebody will be tempted to shell Israel. And the best way to divert attention is get the Israeli Defense Forces invading Lebanon, and then Hezbollah can say, look, it's the Israelis again. You guys forget this sectarian stuff. But that's a scenario. And it, right now, scenarios, the traditional scenarios in the Middle East don't work anymore. So I'm just throwing that out as sheer speculation.
Mm-hmm. And what outcome do you see in Libya right now? Can Gaddafi, is it going to be an entrenched civil war? Or
We've got a civil war in Libya. I mean, you know, the Libyan opposition is talking to the Senate and the House and the White House, and they said, don't worry, you know, we're a bunch of lawyers and doctors, and, you know, we're going to have a civil society to help us get rid of Gaddafi. But we don't know who these people are. Tribal councils in Libya have always been opaque. The tribes have supported Gaddafi. They got jobs. In return, they gave him political support. But there is no military. There's one unit in Libya that actually is cohesive, and it's under Gaddafi's son, Khamis. But at least in Egypt, we had the military to take control of the street. That was a good thing, you know, to see this transition period. But we don't have that in Libya. So if you're a betting man, I would bet for civil war, extended one.
And here's a question from the audience, which sort of follows along in terms of the U.S. relationship with Iran. And you know, it's interesting, the whole nuclear question has sort of been backburnered now, obviously, even though it's still there. So is this a waiting period, or what? How do you see the U.S.'s relationship with Iran, or is this all in transition as well?
Well, I mean, the embargo is still going on. There's still an anti-Iranian lobby. The Iranians are still misbehaving. They just love the nuclear issue because they can push our button. You can predict it any time. When things start to calm down and Washington starts to ignore Iran, they push that button. You know, we got new missiles. Recently the Iranians are just a little bit crazy. They put out a press release that they made flying saucers. So they know what they're doing. But what the thing is, we've got to face it, Iran is winning as of today by default. It is the sole power in the Middle East, which is cohesive, which has an army that's holding together, which is also acting fairly well. It's done well in Iraq. I mean, it has allowed the transition from the civil war and put in a government and has taken Iyad Alawi, who's a Shia, but he's very pro-American, and they're trying to bring him in. And, you know, we can really thank the Iranians a lot for the quiet in Iraq. I mean, we have to face it. I mean, they could have created a complete total hell there had they wanted to, but they knew we were leaving, and they want to put Iraq up as an example of a Shia-led government that works, is responsible, with a modicum of rights, and there's not much, but there's some.
Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guests are Robert and Dana Baer, former CIA officers married to one another, who are discussing their lives in the clandestine service. I want to get back to your life in the service. Dana, what you touched on a little bit, but can you talk a little bit more, this is a question really from the audience, about a woman's role, I guess, a female's role in the intelligence world, and the unique things you may be asked to do or skills you bring?
Well, you know, I think Bob said a little bit. It's so much easier for a woman to do a lot of things. It's you're just less noticeable and you're less suspicious. I did lots of different things that... I rode a motorcycle into a motorcycle that had a camera attached to the back of it, and it was just easier for me to, you know, this was in Athens, and to, you know, to ride it in and a beat up old motorcycle with a helmet on my head and park it and turn a camera on to watch something. It's just less, people just dismiss it. So So there really is a big need and a role for women that makes it easier in the work that I did. Now, I think that becomes different when you're talking about, my job was called an operations officer, so that really ran the gamut of a lot of different sort of things, but it wasn't as Bob's job, which was be specifically recruiting people. And a woman in a lot of the countries, like where Bob worked, would have had a lot harder time, not just because that's the way those cultures work.
They're male chauvinists.
Yeah, and they're just not going to...
A woman can't call up a man and say, hey, you want to go out to dinner, I'm not going to tell you why, and not think that something else is going on. It's just, they're male, you know.
That's true here, too.
It's true here. But, I mean, you try that in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. So you're limited as a woman in some aspects of an intelligence, but in others it's just a complete benefit.
You know what I found was that I had women working for me. They're more meticulous in their reporting. They're better at the detail, checking subsources, getting the complete story than men are. When you're debriefing somebody,
I think there's a couple of questions here about. I don't think people understand you're no longer in the agency, but explain your leaving and some of the work you did afterwards.
Well, we like I said, we met in this operation in Sarajevo that went bad, and by the way, during that whole operation, he did not know my true name. We didn't connect again until we were back at headquarters, and I was walking down a hallway, and he said, hey, Riley. And I turned around and I said, oh, sorry, it's Dana. And, he asked me to dinner, and from there we sort of, things snowballed from there. But
and I proposed, let's take a hiking trip in the Alps.
And just crazy reason I accepted. And that was, but we, we continued to work for a little over a year after that, but it's the CIA is a big, huge place, and my job was different from his, and I was sent on other operations overseas, and he was sent a couple places, and in the interest of full disclosure, we both had marriages to people outside of the CIA, former marriages that in my case failed because of there's too much alienation and separation, and I was traveling all the time, and this is a job where I couldn't tell my husband where I went and what I did, and there's no emails or calling home because you're working in a different name. So it's easy to see how those sorts of relationships just don't survive all that alienation. And Bob has three children from a prior marriage that didn't know he was in the CIA until many, many years later, and it was the same sort of situation. And so once we saw that, here we were trying to be a couple, and unfortunately, and it may have changed in the years since we've been gone from there, but it's very difficult to find like a two-career assignment anywhere. And besides, Bob was sort of the pigpen of the CIA. He always had this little dirty cloud following him around because he was always getting in trouble for one thing or the other. And so any country that was going to take, would say, sure, or any chief of a country, I should say, that would take me was going to look twice about taking Bob because he was always a risky sort of business person. So we looked at it and just the ability for us, we'd be separated again, and we'd already been through that and lost marriages, and Bob was sort of at the end of his career, and he talked me into leaving. I took a leave of absence just because I wasn't sure how things were going to work out between the two of us, and we moved to Beirut right after we left, which was right after the end of the travel ban was lifted, and
we promptly got into trouble. I got her into trouble.
Promptly met a Gulf prince who was trying to overthrow. Well, he was living in exile in Beirut because he was trying to overthrow his country. And, we became friends. We went to his house in Damascus. We met his friends, a nice banker and his wife. And one night back in Beirut, We were having dinner with the banker and his wife, and the banker leaned over and said, "Hey, I got a really good business plan. Let's borrow money from the Gulf Prince, and then we'll just have him killed, and we won't have to pay it back, you know." We got home that night, and I said, "You know, this isn't really a good business plan. So, you know, this another country we had to pack up and move out very quick. Left all our new appliances and all our furniture we just bought, because figuring, you know, we'd certainly spent a while in a rough trade, but we weren't assassins, and just hanging out with people that were proposing murder for hire was probably not a good idea."
And then it got worse from there. You can tell that story.
I'll let you. We went to Iraq.
Yeah, I told Dana, I said, "Listen, the war is coming, 2003, and my friends live in the Western Desert in Ramadi. I'd known them for years. They're Bedouin, very close, and sort of pillars of Saddam's regime. But I figured the friendship was so close, we could go and spend the war with them and wait for the American invasion."
And ABC News asked us to do this.
To go and wait for it and film it. And they called up one day and left a voicemail. And Dana picked it up.
They said, "Bob, your contract to go to Iraq is ready." You know?
I forgot to tell Dana.
I'm going, "What?" So, you know, I promptly reprimanded him for that. And then, so, you know, I sort of got over that. Okay, you know, Saddam was sort of his
I tried to
focus
kill
for a long time. And so I knew he sort of wanted to be there for the end of Saddam. So I said, "Fine, go." But ABC could not find a cameraman willing to go with him to Iraq. So he volunteered me. So ABC trained me to use a camera, and we went to Iraq, and this was, you know, the journalists were all gearing up and were all sort of moving between Jordan and Beirut and Damascus at the time, waiting for the appropriate time to be able to go on into Baghdad. And we met with Bob's tribal friends in Damascus and had dinner with them and, you know, discussed how we were going to get across the border. And they were just sort of like, "Oh, you know, you just take this dirt trail and, you know, you go across the border and then you call us on your Thuraya, the, you know, satellite phone, and we'll come and pick you up, you know." And, we sort of decided, okay, you know, and so we asked... We were in Jordan, and we asked...
Yeah, the Syrians promptly detained us. We were trying to get across the border. And so I had another plan. This was a foolproof plan, and that was a Jordanian prince. There's a smuggling route, and he said, "Hey, it's no problem at all." You know. And he says, "What?" So he sat us down for lunch and said, "I have found some Bedouin who I'll give 100 sheep, and they'll smuggle you across the border." And Data's still deferring to me on all these plans and my knowledge of the Middle East. And
yeah, thinking he's got it all under control.
She knew it was a bad sign. We got a call from the tribe, said there's somebody very important wants to meet you in Ramadi. We can't tell you who it is on the phone. Somebody very important, you'll want to meet him.
So we made plans to go in, and we were waiting for our truck that we were going to ride in the back of with the 100 sheep and cross the border. And... It became a very sad story because we got an email actually that the house and the compound where we were going to stay had been hit with six American JDAM missiles, and all the people were killed, mostly the women and children who had all gathered in one room. And you know, we pieced together the story from the people that we did go into Baghdad with ABC News, and then we did go out to the compound to pay our respects and talk to the people that survived. And it was then that we figured out, you know, there had been some sort of military connection where they had...
Yeah, the half-brother of Saddam was waiting to meet us, and we heard this much later, and in another house was Saddam. And at this point, Saddam was on the run. And he had heard of me from the coup that I tried in 95. And so they just assume you're still in the CIA or confined in the CIA. And he wanted to cut a deal. And so what happened was outside the house we were supposed to stay in, Saddam's half-brother, Barzan, made a phone call, which was intercepted by whomever at National Security Agency, and that's when they fired the six missiles down the signal.
So it was a very...
These were Marwan and Malik.
Right.
And who were in the book, and then these were people you knew well.
They're close friends.
I mean,
it was like family, you know.
These are men you'd sort of cultivated, you'd known them, and really the meeting was set up to meet you, and they were killed. So how do you react to that? I mean...
Dana
does the travel plans now.
You know, but honestly, that took a very, very long time for that to set in, that we had a role in it, you know. And it, in fact, it wasn't until I think we were actually writing the book that, you know, we sat down and talked about it. I think we just put it out of our minds for a long time.
It's like it's a tragedy. You just don't.
Well, I mean, for the most Americans, the Iraqis are stereotypical. You knew them as people and friends. So obviously, in part of the whole, your life is creating assets or people who you work with and you develop a relationship, which is most people don't understand.
Yeah, it's very much all about, we talk about this in the book, it's very much all about relationships and loyalty and trust. And, you know, in the spying world, you can have all the gadgets or the electronic, things, but it's really that human element. And this is what we tried to talk about a little bit in the book, is that translates into family, too, because we both had losses and estrangement from family because we had been gone for so long and because we weren't able to tell people where we were or what we did, that, you know, it's very... that spying is a lot like family. If you don't tend that human element, you're gonna watch what's of value just slip away. So,
I like to say it's like the Odyssey. In the Odyssey, Penelope stays home and weaves and, you know, waits for her husband to come back. It's not the way it works. It's like you go away and you go to strange places and people not really interested in hearing your stories, and you definitely lose family. They move on. They make other bonds. And you come back a stranger, and it's, you just don't get to win it back. And that's, people ask us why we wrote the book, and that's this book about family, a lot of it.
And I think it was, you know, it was sort of an opportunity, or our hope, I guess, is to that we could accurately reflect what it's like for all the people. And there's tons of families too that spend their lives working in the CIA. So it's really about reality, what it is really like on a...
But more than anything, it's about the thing with the military, you know, 5, 6 deployments, what they're asking to give up. You know, I don't support the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq, but I can tell you what the soldiers are going through.
Bob, talk a little bit, or tell us the story of the failed coup, which you were involved in 1995. I think you call it the Bay of Goats episode.
The General Zini called it that. It was a good name. In 1994, I took two congressional aides to northern Iraq. We were smuggled in by the Kurds, and this was Senator Bob Kerry's aide and Senator Glenn's aide. And I took them to the Zab River, which was the dividing line between Iraqi troops and the Kurdish rebels, militia, whatever you want to call them. And at the time, the Democrats were aware there was this movement to invade Iraq, to finish the business we were supposed to finish in 1991. You had Bill Clinton was president. He was considered indifferent to foreign policy, if you like, or it was certainly secondary. He cared about the economy. And Senator Bob Kerry and Senator Glenn decided we really have to try to remove this madman, Saddam Hussein. And the plan was to simply decapitate the regime of Saddam Hussein and leave the system in place, avoid an invasion, get rid of a man who was, like Gaddafi, was the problem. And you know, historians will argue if he was the problem or the whole country was. But anyhow, the thinking was get rid of the guy. I said, well, look, if we set up a base in northern Iraq, we can at least get Iraqi military officers, tank commanders across the border to let us know if they want to get rid of Saddam. And if they ultimately say no, fine. It's, you know, it's their country. but they would need American recognition. I was sent as chief of this base with four other CIA people in 1995, January, went across the border, and almost immediately an Iraqi general approached us representing five senior generals in the Iraqi army and said, we want to get rid of Saddam. Their plan was to create some fighting in Baghdad. Saddam's modus operandi was to go to Tikrit, where he had a palace there, where he felt safe, where he was ultimately captured. And at that point, we had a colonel that had 12 tanks, that he had stolen shells for these 12 tanks. And he was going to take them and their commanders and surround Saddam at his palace in Auja and invite him to step down or flatten the palace. What happened was that inside the government, I can't really tell you what happened. You know, I talked to Dick Morris and people like that, and they all have a different version, is that the National Security Advisor, Tony Lake, had not been informed of this coup, even though we'd written in black and white the hour. It was going to start at 10 o'clock on March 4th, but no one had told Tony Lake or the military. And what happened is we got closer to it, the Iranians found out about it, and they started sending platforms to the border, went on full alert. The Turkish army went on full alert, and the Iraqi army went on full alert. Well, General Shali Kashvili, the chief of staff, is getting these frantic calls from theater saying, we're about ready to have World War III. What's going on? And someone told Shali Kashvili, he said, oh, by the way, the CIA is doing a coup. And he went through the ceiling, called Lake up at 4 in the morning and said, I won't even say what he said. And Lake immediately found Clinton and you know, called him into the Oval Office and said, I can't be National Security Advisor if the CIA is doing illegal coups. And he didn't know anything about any of these messages. This sounds like Washington, doesn't it? So Lake or somebody at the White House calls the Attorney General, calls the FBI, and says, look in, what is going on here? Neither the FBI nor the Attorney General know that this has all been documented. So when we come back from Iraq, me and my team, we're met by the FBI and badged for on murder charges. So this is when Dana's talking about the pig, you know, the little cloud over my head. You know, when you get the National Security Advisor yelling and screaming about you in the Oval Office, you know your career is taking a... So it's been sidetracked.
So you were not a solo op there. That was... You were being directed.
Oh, absolutely. It was...
President was not aware of it?
Dick Morris said the president knew about it and didn't want to tell Tony Lake. You know, who knows? These are politicians. I mean, the point is, I was smart enough when I was in Iraq to know that this was very bad, because you get a call saying, you know, don't call your lawyer, don't stop anywhere, come home, don't tell anybody what happened, and we'll see what we can do for you. So what I did was, you know, in the CIA, there's a strict accounting for messages, and there's in numbers and out numbers. So I couldn't actually take the messages, but what I did is I turned to my communicator, a special forces major, and I said, copy down every number, the time it came in, and the key wording. We wrote it down on a piece of paper. So when the investigation started, no one told the FBI about this. And I sort of pulled these papers out and showed the FBI, and the FBI agents were just furious that they'd been drawn into this fiasco. It was the Bay of Goats. Could we gotten rid of Saddam? Maybe. To go back to our story, once you've been investigated in the CIA for murder... You're working in the basement.
Running
forever.
Running the copy machine, basically.
Behind the coffee machine. So that's why I convinced Dana.
Attempted murder of Saddam. You said.
Right.
Well, it was not only attempted murder. It was RICO Act.
Crossing interstate borders
to commit murder. Because the idea is we left Washington with the idea of murdering Saddam.
Right. So you were the scapegoat. I mean, this wasn't just your idea.
No. There's a total legal authority in this whole thing. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Your career is, is, you know, on the bench.
So now we know why George Clooney wants to be you. You know, all know that Syriana, George Clooney plays his character. So let me switch back to today. Technology is really crucial, obviously, to observation. You described that machine, or I can't even tell you what it did, but the parabolic
mic. Mm-hmm.
But what's the role? Is the key role still human assets on the ground? And when you're looking again at the Middle East today, clearly this is a fluid situation nobody can predict. But where's the melding of the sort of surveillance through technology and on-the-ground intelligence? Sorry. Either one of you.
Go ahead.
Look, you know, very frankly, after all these years, what I really, really like when I'm looking at intelligence is the National Security Agency and intercepts. I can't say any more than intercepts, and that's, I'm permitted to say that. And what you basically is, you've got two people in a country on a telephone calling each other, arguing over who's going to take power, who's going to take control. This becomes a baseline of truth, which all other truth is founded on. So the most important agency is the National Security Agency. The problem is there are trillions of phone calls, and there's no algorithms to pick out what's important and what's not. The other problem is that our intercepts are a fairly linear way of looking at the world, and what you need to supplement that with is overhead photography, Google World, if you like, Google, what's it called, whatever, anyhow, and then human sources. So the first thing you do is give me these intercepts, a pile of them, so I can tell who's who, who's calling, who's on whose Rolodex, you know, and all these things. And then I can go to the sources, the human sources, and start asking them questions that I already know the answers to. It's like a good detective. And then once you find somebody who answers those questions correctly, then you move into a higher level. And the other thing is documents. There's nothing like documents, you know, a piece of paper. I mean, it's the same for journalism. You know, if you those two things, and then you can go on to you triangulate the truth in intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Someone asked if your book was quote unquote censored by the CIA or had to, you know, pass clearance, why is this worth reading? Which I can tell you it is. It is worth reading, but for multiple reasons. But what are the kinds, I guess you can't get into the specifics, but one of the questions I asked earlier.
Oh, I can get into the specifics.
What kinds of things? Like, there are very few dates in the book, for example. What are the things that, you know, get types of things that are deleted or pulled?
Okay, here's what's deleted, and no one cares. This is book five for us. No one cares about what cover I was hired. Do you care if I was Department of Agriculture, an agriculture inspector when I came to Washington in 76? No. I wasn't.
But that's something they wouldn't
allow. That's something they wouldn't allow. There's a contract with the Department of Agriculture that you cannot reveal a confidential relationship. Two is the names of sources. Do you really care the name of a lieutenant, you know, in Syria that was working for me in 1981 who gave me whatever? No one cares. It means nothing to anybody. What they don't censor is politics, criticism, anything like that. And after having, I wrote a book, I'm going to complain. Can I complain?
Sure.
I wrote a book on Iran, which is beautifully sourced, but no one could, I couldn't say where the information came from. And it was fairly, you know, ignored because it just, I stated these bald facts. That is where when you get into a book that academics could use or you could take as authentic that detracts from the book because the reader will say, well, how does he know this? Why should I trust him? This book we wrote doesn't play on this. There's no politics. There's no... I mean, this is the most... I don't know.
Yeah, it's, you know, sometimes I say I don't want to disappoint people because there's no people dressed in ninja suits. There's no wheel kicking. There's some car chases.
No, there's nothing about Monica Lewinsky.
I tell them it's chick lit sometimes because it really is. You know, it's a little bit. It is about family. It's the CIA family and a personal family and how those intersect, and it is about you know, what the life is really like. You know, there's no dates in it because we had to take the dates out because of the way that I worked and the cover that I worked. They wouldn't allow me to, they won't verify my employment for certain dates. So we just took all the dates out. That's, you know, and so there's just, you know, we worked with them for about a year, basically. But there's ways to write the stories that
you remember.
They don't
Dispatches,
care.
The book, it's a fabulous book. I mean, if that's sort of where we were going, something like that, about Vietnam, without going through every battle and the general who did what to whom.
Mm-hmm. What are your? I mean, I don't know if you want to, Dana, explain or one of you what spycraft is, and what is your, do you read? What are your favorite espionage novels? Do you like Alan First? You know, what do you read?
We don't read them. We don't read espionage.
We like The In-Laws, the first one.
The movie.
Seen it.
Modeled his career.
I modeled my career at The In-Laws.
So you don't buy that the espionage books in the 30s, or no period really has any interest for you.
Graham Greene. Yeah.
Graham Greene.
What was the one about Havana? Our Man in Havana.
Our Man in Havana.
Brilliant. Our Man in Havana.
Do they ring true?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I love Our Man.
Mm-hmm.
And Le Carre.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what, how would you define spycraft, which is a term? I mean, you describe in the book you had one of your mentors teaching you, the guy whose name I forget now, your partner.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. I guess we call that tradecraft.
Tradecraft, I
guess.
Stealing the dog, tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, it's the little things you do that I'm not sure you can really learn, but you pick these little things up, you know. If you have to be someplace, you have to have a reason for being places. If you have to be someplace in the middle of the night where, you know, normally you wouldn't see people, hey, walking a dog works really good. Well, if you don't have a dog, you might have to just borrow one. So, you know, if you find a dog in somebody's yard, you borrow it to walk it, maybe through a park in the middle of the night, and give the dog back, and that's a true story. The people were grateful when somebody knocked on their door and said, we found your dog. We're bringing your dog back. And
They remained friends. I mean, when officers went to Moscow, they were issued dogs, especially incontinent dogs. You had to walk in the middle of the night at 4 in the morning. Because you had a reason to be out at 4 in the morning. Otherwise, the Russians would think you were spying. So you took your dog out, and it walking around, and finally the Russians just got tired and stayed away. You know, they stopped watching you.
But it's those little things you have to think about. Like, okay, if you have to be somewhere in a car in the middle of the night, you know, you look for, well, what's open? What could be the reason I'd be there? Oh, there's an all night laundromat. Okay, well, you better have some dirty clothes and some soap in the back of your car too. And you know, this happened to friends of mine, and they were stopped. And fortunately, policemen, what are you doing here in the middle of the night? Oh, I'm just washing my clothes. Where's your clothes? You know, here it's in my trunk. So it's those sorts of things.
Every cover story's got to have a backup.
Okay.
A real serious backup.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question. So I'll ask, would you, if someone asked your advice about should they join the CIA, what would you tell them? And earlier there was a question, would you think it's smart to have almost a training program? I think Colby suggested something like that in the 80s, where it's really almost like a job corps to be an agent.
My personal feeling is I loved my job. I had a great time. I did things I never in a million years would have thought I would have done, and I was forced to do things I never would have thought I could do either. So when people ask me, I say sure, you know, do it, but have a plan B, have a backup plan, because my job was very, you know, in a way, physical and carrying guns and things like that that, you know, are all great when you're young, but don't translate when you get older. And you know, if you want to, you know, have a family and that sort of thing, it's not compatible with that. But if you can get in and do it while you're young, sure.
Smart enough to get in, wise enough to get out.
Okay. Our thanks to Robert and Dana Baer, former CIA officers and authors of the new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Story, Spy Story. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We want to remind everyone here that copies of the Bear's new book are on sale outside this room, and they will be pleased to sign them in the library immediately following the program. We also appreciate your letting them get to the book signing tables as quickly as possible. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.